Welcome to the Out of the Woods podcast, the top five headlines threat hunters need to be thinking of this week.
Hey everyone, welcome to our weekly edition of the Out of the Woods Threat Hunting Podcast. This is Scott Poley here with Lee Argonaut.
Hey everyone, thanks as always for joining us.
And this weekly segment features the top five stories that threat hunters need to be thinking about, as well as our thoughts on the subject and hunting strategies. So with that, let's dive into the top five threat hunting headlines for the week of May 13th, 2024. So I'm going to start with one that's just kind of an interesting take on the current climate with AI. I know a lot of people have talked about AI's, how it's really helped social engineering perspectives, but this one is actually about more misinformation campaigns. And I thought the method utilized was very interesting. So this is actually coming out of the Info Security magazine titled AI-Powered Russian Network Pushes Fake Political News. And basically, their recorded futures mentioned here where they called it a copycat is what they dubbed the group or the campaign. But it really goes around them, their use of how they're using generative AI stuff to actually introduce bias into already known news stories. And that's what I thought was really interesting. So I guess they would get all the major news organizations' feeds, basically republish the same stories and tell the AI, we want to bias this way or introduce these ideas to the same story, which is kind of ingenious because that's kind of what makes misinformation so powerful, is you have enough factual things to make it believable or relevant and then kind of put your narrative over top so that you can kind of change how people think about it. So it was a really interesting take on how they were using AI. Not so much like what we would do to defend against it, but it makes it the use case when we talk about social engineering. Because I would imagine you can do something similar for, hey, we know about these, like when you think about it's tax time or, you know, Valentine's Day, and they have like this specific themed attacks for social engineering. How you might be able to leverage something similar where you can go off of normal advertisements for that and probably something similar. So more nation state misinformation. I see this as also being leveraged in a similar fashion for the common advertisement threads during different times of year as well. So it was just an interesting read, just knowing this is happening and just kind of curious what you thought, Lee.
Going back to large language models, this is something that not only our customers, but I'm pretty sure all of cybersecurity is worried about. Especially as organizations are adopting LLMs, ChatGPT, you name it, whatever technology they decide or whatever solution they decide on, they're implementing this into their processes, procedures internally. So they are now very concerned about, hey, we've trained this model to fit our needs. How do we maintain that it's secure or not? Now, this is something that is a new, I can't say it's a new way, because I mean, we saw this in back in 2020 with, or not 2020, 2016, where it was a more basic version of, I wouldn't say election interference, because I don't think that's the proper term for it. But the fact that they were trying to, or Russia was trying to spread that disinformation over Facebook, sway the votes and stuff. This just seems like the next generation, if that makes sense. Now, what I like about this is that they're already grabbing, or not what they're grabbing, but more about where they're pulling their information from is from the local medias or for national medias. But the fact that now that we're at this stage and that this is on everyone's mind of, Gen AI, and everyone sees the power of the influence this has, that there are companies out there now that are actively trying to discover ways to identify fake videos, fake AI, or AI generated videos. One being Identify or Identif AI, which I think I read an article the other day about where Solid, they actually alerted one of the organizations that, hey, there's this clip going around. It has, you know, has something to reference you in it, or it has something to reference the your customers or whoever is not in charge, but who can be impacted by it. And they're like, look, this is fake. Don't trust it. The fact that we have that technology now, I think it should help out. Now, granted, it's going to help out the people that are interested in digging deeper. And I think this is the crux of the situation. But if people are only going to take things at face value, this technique is going to work. But if people are going to start questioning it and say, well, is this actually real? You know, let me do some research. Let me reference, let me go to foxnews.com to see if this was actually posted recently. The investigated people may find it easier to say, you know, I know this is false, this is fake, and then move on. But once again, it all goes down to who's seeing it, what they're going to do next, and if they are or not, then a question. I feel like we're in a time period of our lives that there's like no trust right now about information coming out online. There's no trust coming out on the media.
That's what I think really interesting is they're basically using popular news feeds that are well-known news organizations, and they're using them because they are considered, say, trusted in quotation marks, right? But then again, it's those are the organizations they really don't want trusted. I feel like originally they were trying to like discredit those organizations. Now they're trying to just leverage it. Like, we're not going to discredit them. We're just going to use them as kind of the tool to get credibility ourselves, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah, and they may be just targeting overall credibility.
Right.
If you can't trust anyone, then, you're kind of like in that paranoid phase. But I'm glad we got companies out there that are trying to tackle this problem. And really, this should be, like, added to the cybersecurity awareness training. Like, just do some due diligence. Is this true?
Yeah. Right. Well, they also have a video forum called Expose Them, spelled out weird, starting with an X. And it's where they actually host up their own video media that basically is supposed to show hypocrisy within their, UK, US type adversaries, which I thought was really interesting. Because they also use the same infrastructure, same server that's geolocated in Russia. So all this media, outside of just knowing the domains and things, they're all coming from the same infrastructure, and it's hosted within Russia. So there are controls people can kind of put around this if they wanted to somehow control information as well. But
that makes you wonder then, like, is it going to be like, they're going to be almost like a footprint if it's coming from the same source all the time?
Right, right.
It's going to be the same artifacts and stuff.
Right.
Always interesting because these types of technology are getting
crazy. You see how they're being used, right? Because we always worry about the actual cyber attack, but there's also other cyber capabilities used in other types of attacks. And this is kind of one of those.
It's like not propaganda. What was that? PsyOps almost.
Yeah.
That's pretty crazy.
So what do you got?
So first up, I have this series that I've been reading from Elastic Security Labs, the company Elastic, and it was all about dissecting the Remco threat, an in-depth analysis of widespread 2024 malware. Now there's four parts, and I really wanted to share this because I read all four, just finished up the fourth one today. And they're real short reads, but I love the technical detail that they put into these. These are very valuable reports that that provide the information that we're looking for. And it's just a good example of the artifacts. They talk about how it functions, or in part two specifically, it talks about diving into REMCOS, its recording capabilities, how it launches, and C2 communication. So I picked this one because it had like a couple, or it touched on multiple different stages. And I always like to see that information versus just one. But it talks about different features of the malware, how it launches itself, what APIs it uses. And specifically, going through, you see some red, like, just reading these, you get the information that you want about, hey, what, once the process is created, what artifacts exist? They talk about registry keys being modified. They talk about when the keylogger starts actually collecting things, where it stores it. So I was just blown away by not only the technical details, but the screen or the screenshots they share, the level that they dove into the code. It wasn't just a like log analysis. It was, there was a lot of static analysis, or so there's a good balance between static and dynamic analysis. So it, once again, getting the most information from both worlds. I just really appreciated it, or the whole series in general. You know, always a fan of screen or keyloggers, always a fan of screen recordings and so on. And I always like to dig in to figure out how can we take this information, make it actionable so that more organizations can use it, and then, you know, ultimately finding the bad. But I just like to highlight this, once again, simply because great article, great technical details, and I hope you go read it yourself. But what was your take, Boyd?
So yeah, I was looking at some of the analysis, and obviously, you know, this one, the second part really digs into some of the core functionality and how the API calls are leveraged to do the different, like, screen grabbing and that configuration, or some of the C2 stuff they mentioned at the bottom. They also talk about how they run commands and things. But there were two main things that I thought were interesting. So one is you can run the REMCOS with watchdog mode, which basically lets you create a process that they then inject the watchdog into. And by doing so, if the main REMCOS process gets terminated, the watchdog will restart it. And then the REMCOS rat, if the watchdog terminates in some way, it will restart the watchdog. So it has like this system built around keeping itself alive and well in the environment, which I thought was interesting. And what was interesting is the registry value that they stored for the watchdog was in the current user software directory under a random mutex. But WD was the key, and the key really only contained from the watchdog the process of the rat that's running. So that could change over time. So it was kind of an easy key to kind of potentially look at. But the other thing that was interesting was, outside of looking for that specific registry piece, is the processes they choose to inject into for the watchdog. And there's the SVC host, which we see a lot, the RM client, .exe, which you would see occasionally, then the fsutil, .exe. And I thought those were interesting because SVC host, it's commonly injected into, I think, a lot of things watch and monitor for that, so they may, you know, choose not to use that just in that case. But it's almost always running, right? Because it's essential for managing all the Windows services. So a lot of the core system service are actually loaded through SVC host. And you can even see multiple instances of it running if you actually looked at your processes. So it's an obvious one. But then when you get to the RM client, which is really associated with group policy settings, either needing to be applied or updated on a client machine. So it runs occasionally, but it's not always running per se, right? So that's something that might be an indicator of something, you know, potentially weird if you're actually looking at things around behavior around that executable in general. And then the other interesting thing was the FSUtil, which is really an on-demand tool only. It's used basically to manage some of the file system things with partitioning and whatever. So seeing it up and continuously running as the watchdog process would be doing would be highly suspicious. So if anything, there's that to look for specifically when you have on-demand utilities that seem to persist and not run and then terminate. That is an interesting artifact in general, and also an interesting thing to think about when you think about command and or process injection are basically on-demand tools that stay persistent within the machine. Obviously, people cannot close windows or shut processes down if they're using the on-demand tools. But in this instance, obviously, they're using it to inject into. So those are the two main pieces that stood out to me from what would I be thinking about from a how would I hunt or look for things about this. And like I said, you kind of covered it too. They just have really interesting insight into how the Remcos RAT can be configured, how it actually interacts with the system with API, which is really smart because harder to detect API interactivity depending on the tool sets you have. But you also have predefined directories that are get defined when you build the RAT of where things are stored and at least what that structure looks like. So even from a maybe not detection or identification artifact, if you were investigating something that you thought might be Remcos based on maybe some other alerting or identification hunting you do, you can use it to help validate that, hey, I think this looks like Remcos on the system. So that was a good read from that perspective.
No, absolutely. I mean, those were all good points. And I think you nailed it, looking for all these different artifacts and once again, trying to figure out what the best way to hunt for in your environment. It is really crucial, but this article helps out a lot.
Cool. Well, I'm going to jump to the next one. This was from The Record. And it was titled Cyber Threat Landscape Permanently Altered by Chinese Operation, U.S. officials say. And they're talking about Volt Typhoon. And really what it came down to is if anyone's been paying attention to what Volt Typhoon, which is associated with the nation state of China, their ability to have gotten into multiple networking devices and routers across footprints, and a lot of those existing within critical infrastructure and even some other devices. And I thought the article was incredibly biased to the lack of understanding of intelligence because having worked within critical infrastructure, this was something that we've always been aware of and looking for, right? Now, granted, they were able to get in and stay there for quite some time. So some of these things are really hard to detect, especially if the intrusion is further out on your edge. So it kind of has the ability to blend in with more noise than being like really deep inside your environment. But, you know, I thought it was interesting that they were kind of surprised and they think that everyone's going to change their attack patterns. And I like to kind of redirect the conversation that the reason why things appear to be changing is because geopolitically things have been changing. And that's usually the driver. So understanding the motive for some of these things really says a lot more than just saying, oh, someone's done it. Now there's going to be more activity because of it. I don't think that's going to influence anybody. I think if people wanted to do it, they'd be doing it anyways. But before, how the world competed was not with any concern of conflict. It was more economical. So a lot of the things you saw specifically from China was not how to necessarily get into critical infrastructure and get into all these areas that may be important to how the country maintains and run itself from the U.S. side. It was more on what intellectual property could they benefit on getting so economically they can compete because they can produce things at a lower cost and possibly meet the needs from a supply chain perspective of the customers that we may be trying to benefit from. And so that's where a lot of effort was pushed. And that's where a lot of people, when they are learning about nation states, they saw China's initiatives. And now because of the potential global landscape where there's could be future conflict with China and other nations, the desire to kind of be closer to, you know, hand on the button, make actions immediate for, you know, impact, not just from a financial perspective, it is more of the motivation here. And, you know, I feel like this has always been the case. Like, I remember thinking, like, everyone always asked when I was coming in and trying to talk to leadership about cybersecurity, like, well, why would a nation state care about this, you know, podunk company here in the middle of whatever when they don't even do international business? And it really has nothing to do with the business itself. It's just they want to have the capability ready. And that's kind of what this is. It's that preparing for, and that's why there wasn't a lot of noise with a lot of activity they were doing. They just happened to get stumbled on and found. So I feel like the article was kind of misleading, as if now we have to worry about this. It globally, if you're aware of what's going on, that's when you know to worry about these types of things. And this is always going to be a motivation for nation states to have the capability, you know, for the what if scenarios if we go to conflict. Especially if you're not really strong allies, because the only thing you worry about there is violating trust. So, yeah, I thought it was a little misleading, but I do think there is a concern that people will do these things, but it has nothing to do that Bolt Typhoon has done it before, kind of thing. So,
yeah, I think one of the first things I remember whenever we first started working together again was that you were explaining to me or whoever was in the room who we were talking about, or two, but I think it's a large group. But you described it as we're treating it like they have their finger on the light switch already, but it's whether they turn off or not. And that always stuck with me. And not to take the we've already been hacked or, you know, pwned mentality. But that's the way you got to treat it, right? You can't be unprepared for if it happens, right? You got to be expecting when it will happen so that if it does happen, you're ready to go. I was surprised about reading about through here about how rampant, I guess, this problem has gotten, not with the critical infrastructure, but with Operation Dying Ember, where the government kicked out Russian government hackers out of a network more than 1,000 home and small business routers. Well, while that may not be directly related to the critical infrastructure, I think that just shows, like you were saying, that they're not just targeting the intellectual property anymore. They want the ability to be on our network, that if push comes to shove and they want to do something about it, they can't. Like you said, the ability to do so.
Right.
I mean, we saw what happened when Russia started invading Ukraine. The first thing they did was knock out the power company or the electric grid. You don't have any electricity, you can't communicate. You can't, you know, you don't have a heat, you don't have, you know, anything to charge your phones, whatever the case may be. So now that we're past that point of intellectual property, you know, grabbing, it's more of a show of force, in my opinion, that, hey, you know, we're here, and if we need to do something, we will. But you're also correct that I remember back in 2015 when I joined you, we were already thinking about how do we protect our critical infrastructure? How do we do this?
We're exactly like these type of attacks, right?
Exactly. Not that they're behind, but maybe it is just getting more. Maybe it's just getting more visibility nowadays.
Right.
Where maybe before it was like, oh, that was a one-off or two. You know, especially with ransomware, how they're kind of just spraying and praying and like, oh, they hit a water treatment facility. You know, they didn't mean to, but it just happened. Now it's they are targeting our critical infrastructure to shut us down. If they were planning on doing something.
And, you know, something that I think, you know, a lot of people kind of forget is Mirai Botnet really was a huge eye-opener to a lot of people, because the ability for the Mirai Botnet to spread to internet-connected devices, all the smart devices that had low-level security or default credentials exposed to the internet, and then them build these massive botnets that people are like, well, who cares about a thermostat? And then you see the massive denial of services that can come from that many things just trying to talk. I mean, at that point, you're just kind of recruiting weapons if that's a service or something you need to be able to do, you know? So that's another capability that I think is all, that actually I think provided more awareness how things can be leveraged and utilized than Bolt Typhoon getting into the critical infrastructure network pieces and things like that. So yeah, I mean, people are always adapting and learning new skills, but just having presence within networks like that, that kind of lay in wait, that was always a nation state prerogative.
Absolutely. Absolutely. They're gonna get as much in, because they don't want to get noticed, right? Mm-hmm. Especially if Pickle's espionage, they don't want to, you know, smash and grab like ransomware. They're just gonna chill.
Right. So cool. What else do you got?
So next up, I took part four of the Elastic Security Labs dissecting Round Coast Rat article or mini series, because this was probably my favorite part. Because it shows the understanding of hunting and detection engineering and what to focus. I know we normally don't touch a lot on detection engineering, but I just want to throw it out there because they did provide some good information. Now, part four focused on detections and hunts using their Elastic Query Language. And what really stuck out was, it's kind of like the approach that I take, that whenever, sometimes I work with our customers, if there is something you're looking at, one thing you don't want to do is limit yourself. So say it's an interesting process that you notice, or that you ran a query and you have this anomalous process. The one thing you don't want to do is restrict your view right away. And what I mean by that is, especially with EDRs and SIMs, what you can filter on is event codes, right? And there's these event codes, we look at different event types. And normally the categories are process create, file creation, network connection, registry key modification, DNS activity, and so on. But if you find a process, normally what I like to do is I like to take a look at what it's doing from an event type view. Because really that will tell me what's going on with this process, or how far or how much access does this process have? For example, if it's just executed to run a command, then maybe I'm not looking for any other artifacts. But if you see multiple different types of event types, then you got to dig a little deeper. For example, if you see the same process running commands, executing commands, creating files, modifying registry keys, making network connections, then that kind of gives you a bigger idea that, hey, you know, this seems to be a bigger problem. And going back to the example of the SVC host acting abnormally, is the process is masquerading as SVC host, which is one of the detection triggers that they provided. You could see that. You can compare what normal SVC host traffic looks like to what this example is exhibiting, or this SVC host is exhibiting. And if you can do that, then you should be able to figure out what's anomalous and what's expected behavior. But they took this, from that general perspective where they provided detection hunts for persistence, process injection, privilege escalation, evasion, command and control, file deletion, and modifier registry. They provided all these opportunities to detect the threat or to hunt for the threat. Once using their own language, but you know that's because of their tool. But you can definitely look at these opportunities and say, you know what? I want to generalize this. I'm going to take it to my environment, and I'm going to take a look at what this activity looks like in my environment. And you might not find process masquerading as SVC host, but if you find some different if you use these detections and hunts to look for other behaviors, maybe that will lead you to a process that is being abused, that is still being masqueraded as a legitimate living off a LAN binary, but it might not be SVC host. And that's what we try to work with the community and the customers, is that how do you take the information that they shared here and how do you generalize it? Because quite, and I know SVC host even says in the article that Runcoast Watchdog defaults to an injected SVC host. Well, that's great because that's default. So you can definitely look for that right away. But if you're treating it like that, it's more like an indicator of compromise where you say, okay, I'm looking for SVC host to act suspiciously or maliciously. If you don't find it, do you stop hunting? Absolutely not. You keep going. What does that behavior look like? Is there any other processes that are behaving differently or abnormally? And so on.
Right.
But this is just a good example of how to approach looking for the same threat in multiple different ways. And that helps organizations prioritize what they're looking for. Say their main concern is persistence. They provide that, or if they look for process injection or privilege escalation. Now, either way, the fact that they didn't just give a one and done, like, here's the detection we build that'll capture all, or only that execution or only the persistence. I really appreciate seeing practitioners put this information out. It is always appreciated because it shows that they're just trying to make the community better and help others improve their posture. But that's my take. What were your thoughts?
So yeah, I really liked how they kind of closed out this series with this, because they really start focusing on a lot of the artifacts and things that you can look for. Obviously, they're kind of showing some of the strength on some of the data fields that they capture within Elastic, which I think is fair because that's kind of why they do these things as well. But what I really liked was when they broke out everything at the top, when they talk about detection and hunt, and they have like the persistence, the process injection, privilege escalation, the evasion, command and control, modifier registered, file deletion. They are links to their actual GitHub where they have these, rules or behaviors kind of built in the Elastic syntax. And I like that because, obviously you have to understand enough of the Elastic syntax to understand like what they're trying to do. But if you've never really dug in to say, well, what does, process injection look like from a data perspective, you at least have some idea of like what data points are important to maybe have visibility to in order to see that. Now, that's obviously not going to cover everything, but, when you're starting from nothing and you're like, I got to solve this problem, these type of articles and those types of resources I think are invaluable because you have something to work from. And that's something in security that's like the most frustrating thing for me is when I have to start from scratch, just because there's so many people in this field and there's so much stuff that they put out there. It's just more of a matter of fact of finding it versus just starting over. And I don't know how many times where I've like started from scratch and through my research, after I'm like halfway through whatever I'm doing, I find where someone has done something that I've been trying to do and possibly even better than what I'm doing. I'm like, oh man, if I just found this first, I would have been saved myself so much time and would have actually covered down on more gaps than I didn't realize existed. So, So I think these articles, especially this one, for that purpose alone, hugely valuable. So yeah, let's check it out.
And you're right. Talking about the threat and then wrapping it up with, hey, here's how to offer it is always appreciated and a very suitable ending. And speaking of wrapping up, how are you going to wrap today's podcast up?
It's funny. I feel like the last few podcasts I've always talked about passwords. So yet again, I have another article that touches on passwords.
But real quick, I'll say something.
Okay.
What didn't we mention today?
DLL injection. But because you had two Remcos articles, there was one that actually was posted that it was a Remcos and how they DLL injected into or DLL sideloading, into a GoToMeeting DLL and how they're. So I was like, I could totally just bring this in, but we'd be beating up Remcos quite a bit. So I strayed from that. But there is a really good article about how they use GoToMeeting and a package that basically dropped a DLL alongside of it because it is vulnerable to that sideloading, and GoToMeeting is a trusted application commonly used. So there you go.
And no mention of a single character
file. Yeah, I didn't see any single character files in anything I was looking at. Now, granted, I didn't look at a lot of technical reports, so it probably protected me from that. But yeah, that one was not mentioned in at least past couple times, I think.
All right, so sorry. I think that broke our like 36-week.
Yeah. So this one's just interesting because it's about passwords, but it's more like password protection on your files and drives. Like, how secure is it? So it really goes into like putting passwords on files specifically, but then they also go into, you know, what are the protections when you say use something like BitLocker, which is using, you know, AES 256 bit encryption, which is strong encryption that, you know, is protected by some set of keys usually associated with your password as well. And, you know, they kind of hit on the fact that, you know, password protection in general, or this level of encryption, really isn't effective like people trust it to be. Meaning if someone were to land on the system when the system is running, and or they're able to steal credentials from the person that's using whatever it is, it then kind of potentially comes ineffective because they can get what they need to unlock the system later. Now, the one thing I thought that was interesting they failed to mention, because they were more talking about how you can impact the system that's running, but if a system is running and it's got BitLocker, the drive is already decrypted. Just like if a database has encryption enabled and it's running, the encryption is not protecting the database, right? It really is only a mechanism to protect things at rest. And they didn't touch on that at all, which I thought was kind of a really big driver, a highlight that they should mention about where is the effectiveness of these systems. Because, yeah, obviously if an adversary is on a system, they can get the keys to things, but if that system isn't running, they can't be on it. So that attack vector is completely gone. So I think it would have been better if the focus was on, okay, this is what encryption protects against. And that is if you're moving devices or moving data that sits on devices that are not powered on, it's a protected system, right? Now, if you want to actually protect the data, like for instance, within a database, then you have to then do another layer of encryption of the data itself that's being stored in the database. And then it gets harder to protect because, like they mentioned here, keys and things that you would use to unlock that have to be systematically stored somewhere in order for some process to basically decrypt the data and, you know, in line or whatever it is. So, you know, how you protect those becomes, you know, a creative. Now, they do talk about beyond software encryption, which is a really good point, because there are devices, like for instance, when you look at if you have an iPhone, I believe Android phones too, depending on the model, there is usually a dedicated chip that handles encryption and then can help have some protective measures around that, where just because you're on the system, you don't necessarily are granted access to things. And then, you know, interesting anecdote about the iPhone, what makes wiping it so fast and effective is they're really just deleting the encryption key. And then all of a sudden now your device is rendered, you know, the data is not readable and you have to go through the whole establishing a new encryption key and reinstalling the OS, or, you know, pulling the OS in from where it's stored. So, you know, that's where hardware encryption becomes really effective. And obviously with a mobile device like that, obviously it makes more sense to have something like that because you don't normally turn your phone off and it's easy to lose your phone. When you use encryption like software-based encryptions for devices that maybe shouldn't be physically grabbed, then that's kind of where you're not worried so much as far as where you use that encryption. Understanding what encryption really solves and what your strategy is and what is actually important, because some, you know, like BitLocker, you're kind of encrypting everything, right? So at that point, you're not really trying to govern what you're protecting. You're just saying we need some protections in place, period. If you actually have critical data, you should actually have a strategy for how you're going to manage protecting that data, either based on the architecture of the systems that can interact with the data, as well as what the data looks like when it's at rest or live, because there's two different scenarios the data sits at. And they do a pretty good job talking about, you know, recovering data, how you do some backups with the 3-2-1 method, you know, make three copies of the data, make two different media drives in case of failure or corruption, and then store one drive in a separate location is a common methodology that people implement so that, you know, you don't have to worry about if there's an issue with encryption, issue with the physical media, and having availability of the data at all times. So, yeah, I thought it was a good thing to call out based on their talking points, but I did hate they failed to mention this really applies to data at rest for really protective controls, which I think is what people need to make sure they understand when they read something like this. What are your takes?
So I actually, I have more questions than thoughts here. Because I know you're the encryption guy,
right?
well, you understand these technologies a lot better than I do. So as I'm reading here, yep, don't get me wrong, software encryption is good, but then, you know, they introduce hardware encryption. And the first thing that, and forgive me if I'm, you know, jaded or whatever, or a pessimist, but as soon as I see the comparison and the opportunity, my mind goes straight to, is this type of mentality going to be used to, like, frighten normal consumers? You know what I mean? So my first question here would be, what would you recommend to a normal consumer of technology? You know, I just bought a new laptop. How do I protect myself best?
Yeah, I'd be worried about theft or anything else. The software encryption is perfectly fine.
Okay. And then, so moving on, I think you may have mentioned it, but I think it might have gone over my head, but at what point do you bring in hardware encryption, and how does that really improve my security?
So one example that is a common business example for hardware encryption, and they even have specific drives for this. And by drives, I mean like expansion cards or devices that you can put in servers. But when you think about cert management for public key trust infrastructure, if you have your CA that is like your master CA, you usually don't want that available online. And you usually don't even want that live. Sometimes you even have an offline copy that's encrypted. But there are instances where maybe you need keys available for certain things, but you need to have a way to get at them that's also protected in this way. And there are dedicated, like there's where I forgot what they're even called because I looked at these such a long time ago. But there are devices that you get specifically for managing just cert-based type keys. Because if you were to invalidate your entire public key infrastructure because of some sort of key compromise, that's a headache. I mean, we see it with adversaries stealing specific like code signing certs and things like that from industry. That now all of a sudden, does that mean their product that they've distributed across the world ineffective or vulnerable or whatever? So it's really important to protect those things. And that's an example of where you might use hardware encryption because it's more tied to how the business functions versus just the data itself. But that comes down to when you identify, well, what's critical and what processes are tied to this critical data and what architecture can we do, that you can get something like that. And those devices are pretty expensive from the price point I was looking at, which is kind of crazy. But they offer a much higher level of protections and controls around how you get at the keys and stuff they store.
Okay. And then reading in the article, you know, they talked about how attackers will target software encryption over hardware encryption because it has the ability to almost zeroize itself.
Right.
Do you see that? And this could be just a, you know, who knows?
Like an attack that just wiped their data?
Well, I was going to say, if they erase it, what does that do to the organization? Almost like a not a denial of service, but a planned destruction of the hardware. Or not destruction, but yeah, like the zeroizing of the hardware.
Yeah, so when they mentioned the 3-2-1 method, the idea, if you did have something that critical and you had a device that was basically tamper-proof, that's what they call it, right? You can't tamper with it, otherwise it basically breaks itself or destroys the data inside of it. That's when you have an offline copy that isn't connected to anything that you were able, you'd be able to bring everything back online as it was. But now you would know there's something trying to get at your data so you can deal with that issue first, hopefully. So that would be an example of how you still handle that issue. You know, the reason why a lot of the software-based encryptions are also highly targeted is because a lot of times that key exists somewhere on the in the system itself as well. Sometimes it's just in memory, but depending on the level of access you have to that system, you're able to get at that key versus something hardware, that key is not accessible on the system. It's stored somewhere completely off system.
Okay.
So
last question, how do you think the whole quantum computing idea, as we work towards that phase of technology, how do you think, what effect do you think that's going to have on them?
So the idea with quantum computing and encryption is you wouldn't really have to steal any keys. You just be able to brute force the keys. And this is where hardware has some benefits because of the tamper proofing, where if you guess too many times, you better get it right in the first few times. So quantum computing doesn't really help with that because quantum computing just ups the game for how often, how well you can guess at, you know, reasonable speeds and really reasonable complexity. So yeah, but when it comes to, say, breaking the encryption algorithms to try to figure out what the keys are, symmetric encryption is more effective than asymmetric encryption. So basically, with symmetric encryption, from what I've read, you could double the key size. So if you're like 256 AES, go to 512, you're basically protected at a 256 level when it comes to quantum computing. But with asymmetric encryption, the size you'd have to get to is so astronomical to make it complex that you almost have to switch to a completely different encryption algorithm for asymmetric. And part of that has to do with its ability to solve. So a lot of, I don't know if it's all asymmetric encryptions, but when you think of asymmetric encryption, a good example is when you're using prime numbers. You know, you multiply two prime numbers together and you get an answer. And now trying to reverse that mathematical process is very hard to do, to say, well, if I only have this prime number, like, how do I figure out the two prime numbers that made this new prime number? It's really hard to do mathematically. But with quantum, that becomes very easy. So it's almost like a linear equation for quantum, makes it very simple to perform. And I remember, I forgot what size key they were talking about, size-wise. But if I remember what I read correctly, it was like, yeah, if you had an asymmetric key that was 1 terabyte, it would be protected. Which isn't even reasonable, right, for someone to be storing. I mean, I know we have a lot of storage sizes, but then I also think of, man, that means if one bit is wrong or gets corrupted in your whole entire key, then it doesn't work either. So then you have two different risks there. So yeah, it's that's how quantum kind of adds to the game of encryption and breaking encryption, from my understanding. Might not be 100% accurate.
Well, it's a lot more accurate than I knew already. So I'm already... thank you for... I know whenever I see articles like this and you bring them to the table, I'm like, you know what? I'm going to just have you explain to me like the best that you can, because I know, work with you previously, you can break things down very easily for people to understand. So I appreciate that, as always.
Yeah.
But yeah, thanks for the explanation, man.
I appreciate it. Hopefully we'll get enough kickbacks where people can correct me that are much smarter than myself.
Community note style.
Right. So with that, that really closes everything out. So I want to thank everyone for joining our Out of the Woods Threat Hunting podcast. Looking forward to syncing back up next week. And that closes out our top five threat hunting headlines for the week of May 13th, 2024.
Happy hunting, everyone.
Happy hunting.
Thanks for listening to the Out of the Woods podcast. Be sure to subscribe wherever you heard this podcast so you never miss an episode. For more information or to connect with Cyborg Security, check us out online at www.cyborgsecurity.com and follow us on social media. We'll see you next time.